Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of January, and we are going to be talking about President Barack Obama's address yesterday, his inaugural address. To quote again Roger Simon's piece in Politico, Barack Obama has always been about words, and so it was yesterday. For all the grandeur of the setting and the breathtaking and seemingly endless crowd arrayed before him, it was still about the words, and we will analyze those words this hour of the program and talk about the and I think this is true. Most of those who have commented on this speech have said that it was a very serious speech, and I think it was a very serious speech as we are living in serious times, our nation at war. He made reference to our economy in very bad shape. He talked about homes that have been lost and businesses that have been shuttered. And he, of course, also talked about hope and that we are a young nation and we need to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and begin again the work of remaking America. So we talk about the speech this hour of the program, and our guest is joining us and is an expert, actually, in this whole area. Professor Wayne Fields is the Lynn Cooper Harvey Distinguished Chair in English at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a nationally known expert on American literature, nonfiction, prose, rhetoric, and American political argument. He's the author of Union of Words, A History of Presidential Eloquence, which looks, of course, at the use of rhetoric in presidential speeches. And that includes declarations of candidacy to nomination, acceptances, inaugural addresses, State of the Union speeches, declarations of war, executive farewells, and other special addresses. So many of you who tried to get through last hour and were pretty crowded here today, as you can imagine, couldn't. I would imagine that a lot of your calls will fit in just fine this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. Professor Wayne Fields, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
I thought there was a little difference in tone in his address yesterday, that it did seem more serious, that he had a sober look on his face as we watched him, that he let us know these are extremely difficult times.
No, I think that's right. And I think that it was a restrained speech in a way. I mean, there's nothing in it that sort of declares itself in spectacular terms. I mean, I think the pressure from commentators to find the quotable line, the "ask not what your country can do for you" line, is submerged in a speech in which everything is tied to everything else. So it's quieter that way. And yet, you know, the sort of spine of the speech is this: it's time for us to grow up, it's time for us to take responsibility, it's time for us to get to work. And we know how to do this because these are shared values, this is our shared tradition, this is our common story. So it was positive at the same time as it didn't try to be bouncy or ebullient in some way that's, in a sense, out of temper with the way we feel right now. The celebration was the joyous thing, that we've come this far, that we've done this together. It was about what we have done, not simply about who we have elected.
Would it serve him well to have had a quotable line? I'm sure he thought about it as he was crafting this speech, or does not make any difference?
I think that actually in this speech, and all speeches have to be placed in context, that this, for this moment, was the right tone and the right mood, that it was assuming that we are capable of paying attention and following a whole argument, that we can look at the whole thing and not have it somehow reduced to a particular soundbite. I think that's part of the maturity he expects from us. And also, those lines are designed primarily to call attention to the speaker. I think here that there are lines that will get quoted. There are passages that will play and replay, especially the ending, I suspect, because they are inspiring and they do represent the rhetoric of this presidency. But the common and the most frequently used words, at least as I remember them, the word "common" and the word "work." And he comes back to those over and over again. The language he uses is common. We don't have to run the dictionary to look up any words. And the syntax is a syntax we're comfortable with. It's the grammatical structures that we know from our own discourse. So there's no overreaching, because at this moment, the way we're going to get out of this is by doing what we know how to do, and that's to take responsibility, and that's to work.
That's interesting. And he is, I think he is about the words. It was a lovely sight. It always is to hear him speak, because he crafts words so beautifully and really rises to the occasion. When I talk about a difference in tone, there was, you could just see it on his face. You could hear the urgency in his voice. It was very different, I think, than a lot of his campaign speeches.
Well, I think so, too. And part, that's for the first time he was speaking to us as president.
Right.
That's a different relationship. That's a different burden, a different responsibility. And also, for the first time, we as a nation were already celebrating something. I mean, that enormous crowd was as much the punchline of the day as anything he could have spoken. That was there to see him be inaugurated, but they were there to be together, in a sense. It was a powerful representative of our desire to be one people. And I think that provided the profoundest note of eloquence in the day, and that he very consciously didn't take away from that. That it's about the first person plural all the time. It's we and our that he talks about, instead of an I that's going to be remarkable and stand apart. He is remarkable, and he does stand apart, and he doesn't somehow feel the need to prove that, it seems to me.
How true. And it must have been such a moment for him. It certainly was to watch this event when he gave his speech, and there were millions of people right in front of him waving the American flag. What a sight that was.
And I think, you know, part of what is, for somebody of my age, and I came of age during the civil rights movement. I was in high school and college during the most tumultuous days of that. What was remarkable was this, what he calls this patchwork heritage, being embraced. I mean, there's a really wonderful moment at the end of the speech, it seems to me, that you only find on rereading, where he makes the transition from talking about his father, the father who less than 60 years ago couldn't have been served at a local restaurant, and whose son now stands before you to take this most sacred oath. And then in the very next paragraph, he moves to another father, Washington, the father of our nation. And what he asserts in that moment is that journey between those two experiences, between the father who can't be accepted at a local restaurant and the man who can stand up and claim George Washington is a part of his heritage, a part of his identity, a part of his legacy, means the stories that we've tended to keep apart in American life, that we've had a black story, a white story, a red story, that somehow a part of what we're doing is bringing those together, that we have one story, and that's what he was trying to affirm, it seems to me, as much as anything else in this address. Mm-hmm. And that wonderful moment at the end links those two fathers directly.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't hear the speech that way. That's a great way to examine it. And it's interesting to me, I think, that I expected Lincoln and I got Washington. In a pretty dramatic fashion, I got Washington.
Well, you got Washington, you got FDR, you got Reagan in some ways, but what you got of Lincoln was, I think, the seriousness of it. That what he has done as he approached the inauguration, whether it was the Philadelphia experience, is immersed himself in the way in which Lincoln built up resolve, the way in which Lincoln steeled himself for the personal challenge of the presidency, which was unlike anybody has ever faced. And I think that there is, at some level, in terms of the values and the sense of what really matters to us, the instruction of Lincoln all the time.
Mm-hmm. A couple memorable areas for me. Well, I think this is a fairly powerful statement, and it's all reference to greed and to those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent. Know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist.
Yeah, some of those lines apparently were censored in the Chinese broadcast and publication of the speech today.
I heard that this morning, right?
Yes, I think, and that also echoes elements of Kennedy's Cold War speech. And I think that part of what he is trying to announce is a new day, an America that is rebuilding itself on its old values, but values that we, generation after generation, struggle to more fully realize. And representing this to the world, he's very much aware that this speech was watched by more people abroad than even at home, that this is a moment in which the entire world is hungry for leadership. Whether it's grasping at straws, given the youth and relative inexperience of this man or whatever it is, that the attention is from everywhere. And the Central American challenge through all of our history is the world's challenge. Can we be one and many at the same time? And part of what the selfishness and greedy condemns is not simply because the values are warped. There are more important things than that than those pursuits represent, but that they are a denial of our responsibility to one another, our interconnectedness, our community, which is where our deepest security, our deepest pleasures come from.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that he's got so much to do, that if he is successful 4 years from now or 8 years from now, if he is not successful, that we will judge him more, that the words will become more important to us as we move through in history because he's either a great president or he's not a great president?
I think so. I think that part of what he was doing yesterday, and that's what I meant earlier about not calling so much attention to himself, was reminding us that this is our job, not just his. We've gone through a period in which we have sort of delegated things. We said we were in a war against terrorism, and we committed troops to the sacrifices that that war requires, and then we were told that the way we could prevail was to go to Disney World, to buy more things, to live normally. And what he's saying now, I think, is that a part of the growing up we do is, no, we all take responsibility, and we all participate in the sacrifice. Not just a few at the bottom or even in the middle of the economic scale, but those who have been rewarded in times of prosperity excessively, that all of us somehow are part of the solution or there is no solution.
Mm-hmm. You, as a professor of English, have expertise in presidential speech making, et cetera, must find this a welcome time. No matter what your thoughts are politically about this man, he sure can speak. He sure can put together words.
I think that's right. And I think what people forget is that he puts together ideas in those words and that they seem in harmony with one another and that he builds over time. I mean, what I've been impressed by since he first sort of appeared on the political scene at the Democratic Convention 4 years ago has been the way in which he grows, and in a sense we grow with him, that the ideas get more complex in one sense, even as the language seems sometimes to get simpler and more direct.
Mm. And that's what happened yesterday.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. I liked this speech. I didn't think it was a great speech. I thought it was a very good speech. And you're talking about drawing in different presidents. I mean, I was really surprised to hear the personal responsibility, which is very, I guess, Reagan-esque, you could say, when it comes to, you know, we have a personal responsibility. What I liked about it is there was much more substance to it, and it seemed like the analysis, you heard everybody looking for more symbolism. There wasn't no big one-liner, the memorable thing. And my opinion, especially the times we're at, and maybe that was Barack's point, is we don't really need symbolism. We really need some substance to get us out of the malaise we're in. And I thought he really was really direct and really on point when it came to the substance of the speech as opposed to the fluff and symbolism, which doesn't really get anybody anywhere today.
Well, I think that's a very good point, and I think you're right that the intention of the speech was to be direct. I mean, it's again the matter of taking responsibility, getting to work, and doing it together. That this is an American task, not a military task, not a task for experts in the bureaucracy, that somehow we have to come together around this. And this is essentially the lesson I think he and the rest of us have learned from Franklin Roosevelt's approach to the Great Depression, that we work our things, our way out of things, and we work our way out of them together or we fail.
Mm. Thanks very much, Scott, for the call. Evangeline from Hudson is next. Hi, Evangeline.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And the only line in the whole speech that bothered me was that he didn't think he had to apologize, or that we should apologize for our way of life. Didn't that strike anybody else as strange, since we consume way more than any other country in the world, and basically we have pretty much a selfish lifestyle?
Well, I think he was trying to address that, because later he talks about the problem of those nations that consume an inordinate amount of the world's energy and things like that. I think when he was issuing an apology, it was about our commitment to freedom. I think it was about the fundamental values, the old values, of which that consumerism is not a part. That kind of excess is not a part. I think what the Chinese recognized when they took out the sections about dissent and everything else is that this is in fact the part of it that we will not apologize for, that we will not yield on. And he's specifically addressing those who are hostile to more than simply the plenty that we have, but have been hostile to the values that perhaps have created that plenty. But I think he's trying to deal with both of those. And I think that what he's not apologizing for is our commitment to democracy, our commitment to freedom, our commitment to liberty. But what we have to grow out of is our commitment to excessive consumption, our childishness in demanding more and more.
Yeah. And he made specific reference about consuming resources without regard to the effect of that consumption, which I think did call on people to think about their SUVs, as it did our guest the last hour of the program. Thanks very much for your call. We have lines open, and we'll welcome more phone calls momentarily. We are looking at President Barack Obama's inauguration speech that he gave, of course, yesterday, and welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone lines are open for you now, and the email as well, for you to respond to the words of President Barack Obama yesterday, his inaugural address, and our guest is also written about inaugural addresses and other speeches given by presidents, so we can do some historical comparison here as well. Professor Wayne Fields is a nationally known expert on American literature, nonfiction, prose, rhetoric, and American political argument, and he is author, among other books, of Union of Words, A History of Presidential Eloquence, looking at the use of rhetoric in speeches from our many It's not that many when you think about it. Presidents of the United States. 800-486-8655. Just to go to another speech here, because I'm sure you heard the whole thing with our focus on Barack Obama. But we have an email wondering about your opinion of Reverend Lowry's speech, in particular how he called out people by race at the end of the address.
Well, I thought that I actually missed much of it the first time around because I was doing an interview very quickly after the speech. But I think in light of that reference to patchwork heritage and the way the audience, which was a patchwork crowd, responded to that part was stirring and striking. That we're getting to a point where you can both joke and be serious about the struggles that we've been through and continue to be through to become one people. And I think that that overarching concern for the whole day was, and to some extent that's true in inaugurations. There's a great line in Ronald Reagan's first inaugural where he says, "How can we love our country if we don't love our countrymen?" And I think that part of what the Reverend Lowry was doing was reflecting in a way that was lighter than anything that the president had to say, the way in which we're moving towards that common affection.
Really like the poem. I haven't heard much commentary on the poem, but I like the poem.
Well, I can tell you the poets, and I work with many of them, one of whom did an inaugural poem years ago, find occasional poems, poems written to special occasions, very, very difficult to do. Robert Frost wrote one for John F. Kennedy, blew away in the,
The
windy January weather, and he recited an older poem, which in the long run turned out to be a more appropriate application. What is the first significant thing about that is that a president recognizes the importance of poetry, the importance of this part of our life and heritage, and then that you find a poet of that stature who's willing to take on an occasional poem. So it just having a poet there is a significant thing to start with. And then the words almost always are hard, I think, for a poet to write because of the occasional nature of them, and yet should be appreciated for that reason, right, too.
Bill from La Crosse, hi.
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 My comment would be, I see a lot of parallel with Kennedy's American University speech, where he said, we are on the Cold War, we are on the wrong track, and we need to get off this track. Here's how we can do it. And in many ways, I think that Obama's speech was like that, a person in authority saying, we are on the wrong track, we need to get off it, and here's how we can do it.
Well, I think that's right, and I'm glad you pointed to the American University. What kind of peace do we want? Speech. I actually admire that more than anything Kennedy ever did otherwise, because of exactly the way he represents that. And he tends to do the same thing in that speech, in contrast with the inaugural address, which has these formal constructions and these elaborate rhetorical phrases like ask not. But there he is simple and direct, and it's about common values, common aspirations, common ambitions internationally. What Russian parents want for their children, we want for our children. What people long for is consistent. And I think almost always when presidents call us to union or when they speak to the world about a shared commitment, it's on the basis that we long for the same things. We hunger for the same sort of things for our families, for our lives. If that's the case, then why are we divided? Why are we broken? So it's this movement, this longing for wholeness that drives, I think, the best of our speeches, whether it's Kennedy's or whether it's Obama's.
Hmm. Anything else, Bill?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. This may be stretching it, but I have to ask you anyhow, because I'm from Chicago and you went to school in Chicago at the University of Chicago. I want to talk a little bit about Chicago here and what he may bring in terms of kind of this mid, although he's got a world sensibility, but there's something about, he makes reference to Chicago, a lot of his staff from Chicago. A friend of mine long ago kept talking when we were in high school about how Chicago is known as a city of workers. There's a work ethic. It's not a glamorous city. It's a wonderful city. There's lots of great art and museums, et cetera. But people work. You know, it's cold, and they work hard. Is there something about that kind of sensibility that he put in the speech yesterday and then he puts into this administration, or am I making too much because I'm from there, of Chicago?
No, I think you're right. I think that I'm very much a Midwesterner, so I'm reflecting my own prejudices here. But this seems to me to be as much as anything about values that I think of as Midwestern values, starting with that notion of work. My father was a carpenter. His father was a farmer and a carpenter. You know, that this is the tradition I've come out of and the way in which I think of work, which makes it hard sometimes for me to think about what I do for a living as work, but because it's so different than that. But the lunch pail notion of work is, for me, quintessentially Midwest. In recent years, people have tried to talk about it as Joe Sixpack, that it's what we do with our leisure that makes us different than the rest of the country. I don't think that's true. Milwaukee, Chicago, Pittsburgh, these are cities in which we know what it is to do hard work and to do it for our families and for our children. So I do think that it has a special role, and it seems to me appropriate that the two coasts remember that we're the ones that hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it all comes together, and this is where, to some extent, when we think of economic terms, we're most at danger of having it come apart.
Hmm. Thanks so much, Bill, for your call. Our number, lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about President Barack Obama's inaugural address yesterday and some of the other speeches that were a part of that remarkable celebration. And asking what you think. I want to talk specifically about what he said to the Muslim world yesterday and how you think it may be taken in today and to people in different countries who have listed us as an enemy. To the Muslim world, he said, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect to those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West. Know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you can destroy. There are a lot of meaningful lines in this, even though we can't quote them. But what do you make of his reaching out to the Muslim world?
Well, I think it's a very important section for two reasons. First of all, you don't have references to the Muslim world, or at least direct references, in earlier inaugural addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first significant thing, the first sign of respect, is we recognize that you're there. For many years, we've recognized only the difficulties that they represent for us, the estrangement. But here's a man with a name that Muslims are familiar with, saying, we recognize that you're there, and we take you seriously as people, not simply as terrorists, that we assume that your longings and our longings are consistent with one another. But know that we will be strong even as we will be open to you. And it seems to me this is an important sign of respect, that we're not dealing with them simply through surrogates, nations who through colonial experience are tied up with them, but that as a part of the community of nations, part of the world's peoples, we as a nation, we as a people recognize them, take them seriously, both in positive and negative terms.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jake from Menasha. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question. I listened to the speech yesterday. I didn't hear any reference at all made by President Obama regarding his mother and his grandparents, his mother's father and mother, who basically raised him, and that they were white people. And I also wanted to ask the guest, how did Barack Obama become the African American? I mean, it's like his mother and grandparents just didn't exist.
Well, I think that, first of all, you know, his entire pre-election story had focused a lot on those people. The fact that his grandmother died just before the election, you know, all of that folk, and is telling his story, he has stressed how important they are to him. There was remarkably little reference in this speech to what he represented. I mean, just that one, and then it's said as a historical reference, that one reference to the father who wasn't in Washington in that time, so there wasn't a specific story about his father, but the father who, as a black man, couldn't have sat in one of those restaurants, and how now that's the son of that man is being sworn in as president of the United States. I think what he's been doing throughout the campaign, and what he was doing in the close of the speech, what he was doing by not calling attention, as everybody else was, to his racial identity, mm-hmm. is saying those things that have divided America, first of all, and that we have thought to be the source of sort of endless conflict of interests and concerns, I'm comfortable within myself. I have a Kenyan father. I have a white mother. And it's very clear he's comfortable in that, in his identity. And at the end of the speech, what he's saying is we do not have a black story and a white story as Americans. We have an American story. It sometimes involves conflict, but we are moving towards the fullness of union in which we have overlapping identities. And I'm not talking biologically so much as I am culturally and citizenship, where we are members, in the biblical language, members one of another. And I think that's been the thing he's aspired for. I think that's the way he's resolved for, in his own mind, his own identity, is that somehow he can be all of those things and not be divided against himself, and so can America in that regard. So I don't think he left them out because he was choosing black over white. I think what he did was refuse to make this a speech about his identity, because then he might be suggesting some conflict and all that, or he might be exploiting the uniqueness of who he is. And I think he's, again, it's about us all the time. And even that reference, which isn't really a personal, private reference to the man who can't be seated in a Washington, D.C. restaurant, is in historical context, and almost immediately that father gives way to sort of the ultimate white father, the father of our nation.
Yes, right, right. I will forever look at the speech differently because of the way your reference there. And when you talk about unique, you know, I know the story, but every time I hear it, the fact that this guy has a Kenyan father, a Kenyan grandmother who shows up to the inaugural, and they have a Kenyan inaugural ball yesterday, that he's got this Indonesian background. It's just, it's so striking to me. You're just not going to find too many presidents who have this kind of background. I think it's significant in a whole lot of ways that will play out in the years ahead.
Well, I agree with you. I think there were two sort of really impressive things related to that issue. One is that I'm 66 years old. Most people in my demographic group, starting in the caucuses in Iowa, if you look at the voting patterns, did not see America when they looked at Barack Obama and they voted for somebody else. Most people under 25 looked at him and saw America and voted for him. And it seems to me the change that's taken place since the immigration laws were changed in the 1960s and 70s, the student body that I see every day on my campus looks very, very different than the student body that was here when I first arrived. And I think that part of what we see for the first time, certainly in this kind of position, is what a cosmopolitan people we are. At the time of World War One, Woodrow Wilson said, you know, we're a nation of many nations, and all the combatants in the European conflict's blood runs through us. Well, now we can increasingly see that all the nations of the world are represented in our nation. And there's something exciting and wonderful about that, even as it's unsettling. So I think part of the challenge for Obama yesterday was to reassure us that we are one in spite of that, that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness, that we can rise the way the greatest generation, whatever we call the generations of the past that faced times of crises, we can rise to that occasion even though we look different from one another and different from them, because fundamentally we share the same values and that we're committed to the more perfect union of those interests and that community.
Right. Ain't that America? Yeah. Jake, thanks very much for the call. We go to Aaron from Harvard, Illinois. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you?
All right. How are you?
Doing good. I had a guy I worked with that used to say, effective people don't know the right answer. Effective people are the right answer. And I'm big into community involvement. And when I voted for Barack Obama, and the reason why is because it seems like one of the undercurrents of everything he talks about is, you know, guys, if you have an elderly person next door, you don't need a social program. Why don't you go get the shovel and shovel out their driveway? Why don't you help each other? Why don't you guys do things to each other? Because you're human. And government isn't the answer, always. And yes, we need programs, but I hear this underpinning of we need to develop an attitude of volunteerism. And I even heard that in the inaugural speech. And I'd like to hear your perspective on that. If I could, and I'll take it off.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think there was, although we've heard that for some time, whether it was 1,000 points of light or what else. I think that it's here part of a package of responsibility, a culture of responsibility that has two edges. One is you should do those things because they're the right thing to do. There's a kind of oughtness, a kind of moral imperative in all this. But we should also remember we do those things because they're the most satisfying aspects of our lives. That we have, in a sense, deluded ourselves for any number of years by believing that by taking care of ourselves, hoarding up for ourselves, we were doing what we most wanted to do. But at another level, what we know we most want is to be a part of something bigger. What we want is to be a part of a community. What we want is to be able to count on our neighbor and have them count on us. That maybe more than the 401k, is where our sense of personal security and our sense of personal happiness should lie. In Jefferson's first inaugural, when the country was almost to come apart over partisan differences, and he declares we're all Republicans, we're all Federalists, he says, sure, we'll come back together, we will reunite, because that's the only way we have social discourse, and that's where we get our deepest pleasure, our deepest joy. We need each other for our happiness, not just as customers. And I think that's part of what Obama's reminding us. He's trying to make a cultural shift where we turn away from the idea that work is something for suckers, for people who don't win the lottery, for people who didn't get the right stock at the right time or manipulate the market in the right ways, to the notion that work is a part of our human value. It's part of what we find meaning and happiness in. And it's that recognition, I think, that the whole effort at recovery depends upon.
And let's pause for just a moment. Return to your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Professor Wayne Fields, Lynn Cooper Harvey, Distinguished Chair in English at Washington University in St. Louis. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls. Jerry Ann from South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I think, like everyone else, was sort of listening for that one catchphrase, that one memorable soundbite, and was almost a little disappointed at the end of the speech that there was nothing to really latch on and just a few memorable words. And I didn't think about this until I heard your conversation on the program this morning, that may not have been an accident, that perhaps President Obama did not want to have what he had to say, have his message boiled down to a slogan or a soundbite, that what he really wanted is what's happening right now on your program today, Kathleen, and that is for people to really analyze what he said. If he had given them the easy route, the ask not what you can do for your country type of catchphrase, that your program, while you may still have had it wouldn't have had the same substantive analyzing that you and your guest Professor Fields were giving. And I just like to know what Professor Fields thinks of that.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Well, I think you're right. I think this is a president like the other writerly presidents we've had, whether it was Jefferson or Lincoln, who never does anything by accident in a speech. I think that it's all very carefully and consciously developed. And I think the two things that you pointed to are there. One, he's taking it seriously. When he talks about growing up, it's paying attention. It's being able to deal with the fact that everything we're facing now is interrelated with everything else. You can't put domestic here and foreign here. You can't say environmental issues and national security are in different boxes, that health care and the economy are in different boxes. They're all interrelated, that we are all interrelated. So everything in the speech, it seems to me, is of a piece by design, meaning that we have to look at the whole all the time. He didn't set a priority list. We'll solve this problem. We'll go to that problem, because none of these problems can be fully extricated in the tangle of all of them. So it seems to me that he was comfortable enough with our abilities as an audience, as FDR was, to say, this is difficult stuff. This is complicated stuff. But we know how to deal with this. We grow up, we take responsibility, we go to work. We will find our way through this. And over and over, whether he's talking about our historical journey, whether he's talking about our individual lives, it's about how we grow. And we will learn in this. He doesn't offer us the answers up front. He offers us the process by which we will find answers, by growing together and by solving all of this. And I think what's exciting about the speech is that he was comfortable enough not to spend all of his time straining after a line that would show up in stained glass windows and in the evening news.
Right.
And so I think you're exactly right. I think what the message was, this is something we're in together. I will talk to you directly, clearly, plainly, and at the same time there is in the wholeness of it, in the thought of it, in the sentiments of it, a kind of poetry that's as powerful, I would argue more powerful in its own ways than some of the speeches we so much admire for their punchlines.
Hmm. I know he spent some time, well, he spends a lot of time reading Lincoln, but he spent time in preparation for this speech reading Lincoln's second inaugural, which I still think is the best ever written by anybody.
Oh, I think so, too.
Marvelous. What do you think he – two questions here. One, did you see any of the thought process or the seriousness of that address influencing the address that he gave yesterday? That's the first question.
Well, I think – you know, one of the things that he does very effectively, I think, is give speeches in the context of the occasion on which they're to be delivered. He doesn't make the mistake of thinking that the occasion for this speech is the same as the occasion for FDR's or for Lincoln's first or second inaugural. So he can be informed by those, but he doesn't imitate those. He can echo the values and the thoughts of those, sometimes even the phrasing of those, but he is speaking to us in this moment. And for me, a great speech is measured not so much whether it's going to get listed in the Oxford Book of Poetry in 12 or 15 years, but whether it's the right one for the situation and the audience of this moment, and whether it lets us move forward. That the whole point of rhetoric is to give us a way of dealing with uncertain issues, of giving us a way of somehow finding our way forward, and that he understands that. So it's a process. The speech builds on things that he has said in earlier speeches, the speech given the night of the convention, which some people probably will find more effective, the speech on race, which may be the one that we quote for the rest of American history, the one he gave at the Democratic Convention that catapulted him into national attention. But what he does each time, it seems to me, is think about who he's talking to, what their real feelings and circumstances are. And it's that taking us in the moment seriously that elevates, I think, this rhetoric to a different level than we're used to.
Yeah. The race speech, it's interesting you bring that up. David Axelrod, I read somewhere in reading about all of this that when he heard the race speech, he said to Obama, because the speech brought tears to his eyes, as it did to many of his advisors, and he said, "This is why you should be president."
Yeah. Well, I think there's some truth to that.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call, and let us go now to Joe from Gays Mills. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you brought up Reverend Lowry's speech, because I saw him the night before the inauguration on a political show, and they were talking about he was going to deliver the benediction, and the other clergyman was going to deliver the benediction. But he was talking about, and here's a man who's seen it all, and he was talking about, well, how long are you going to talk? And he says, well, we're supposed to have 2 minutes, but I'm going to keep an eye on Reverend Warren and see how long he goes and take it from there. And he was, and then when he did speak at the end of the, or towards the end of the inauguration, and he was talking about, you know, Obama talked about the patchwork, and one of your callers brought that up, and they're talking about the, and Lowry brought up, you know, the, I think it's a big Bill Brunzi tune, if you're white, you're all right, if you're brown, stick around, if you're black, get back, get back. And I just thought that was perfect. But the thing that really humbles and is refreshing is for a person such as himself who's seen it all, and for him to maintain his humor and to realize the importance, but to it's about survival and striving, and I thought that was perfect. And also in the context, the night before, on the eve of the inauguration, reading Studs Terkel's 1961 interview with James Baldwin.
Oh.
It's all quite a stew.
Yes.
That's a
wonderful point, and I think it's absolutely crucial. I mean, one of the exciting things for me, given my age and my commitment to civil rights at the time as a student, is seeing people like Andrew Young, John Lewis, Reverend Lowry, These are the faces of the struggle that preceded Barack Obama. These are the people that paid the price and paved the way, in a sense, for a reconciling America that Obama represents and speaks to. And there's something in the joy, the fun, if you will, of Lowry, who has seen so much of suffering and pain to get here. John Lewis breaking down in tears, not for himself or for the terrible hardships he went through during the movement, but because he felt like he had to represent somehow all those who have gone. And he included in that list not just Martin Luther King, but Lyndon Johnson, all those who in some ways did something that led us to this moment. I think what we celebrated yesterday, and I think that's what Lowry was particularly excited about, and what will take a long time to sink in, is not the miracle of having a president who is black and named Barack Obama, but the miracle that Americans elected him president, mm-hmm. that we chose this, that we've come this far in the Reverend Lowry's lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different way to look at it. We elected him. Thank you very much, Joe, for the call. We go to Karen from Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. What a wonderful couple programs this morning. I'm 66 also, and so is my husband. I did door knocking and telephoning for Obama, and when I heard the speech, both of us sat here and said, oh, he is so clear in his thinking, and he has so much depth of thought. And then when he came near the end and he said, so we need to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and begin anew, I right away thought of this song in an old Fred Astaire movie, which
exactly.
is where that phrase comes from.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up the lyrics. They are so perfect. And that, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again, is very memorable to me. And already, I have used that phrase this morning with our five-year-old grandson, who's here, when he got frustrated with the task he was trying to do. And I said, this is what Barack Obama is telling us to do. Don't give up. And thank you so much for your wise comments, Professor, and thank you, Kathleen, for scheduling these programs.
Yeah, we wouldn't
well,
do anything
thank
else.
You.
Thanks,
and
thanks,
I think
Karen.
Part of the fun, as well as what's so powerful and moving in Obama speaking, is how many voices of our culture. One side it's Lincoln and Washington and Martin Luther King, but we also hear the lyrics of a Fred Astaire song or in the acceptance speech a Sam Cooke song. That things come together here, and I think that's what's been most exciting, even if we don't know where we're headed right now specifically.
Mm-hmm. And I like her phrase. I do think there's a lot of depth of thought here, that even those who disagree with this president understand the depth of thought of him. He's a man of substance, I think.
No, I think that's right. And I think that's the reason, a friend of mine was surveying the blogs yesterday, a thing I am incapable of doing, and finding lots of positive responses on both sides of the political spectrum, as well as complaints from both sides. But when you hear people like John McCain comment on the transition, comment on the way in which they have been treated personally, as well as professionally by President Obama, essentially what they are hopeful for is not just his willingness to listen to them, but for the seriousness with which he listens to give us more options, more possibilities, a profounder sense of where we are and what we do.
Thanks, Karen, so much for your call. We go to Bill next from Orchardville. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning. Wonderful show. I just thought I'd say that, listening to your discussion on values and morals, it appears to me rural America live like that already. We don't have to be reminded to love our neighbors and to do those kinds of things. And it's when the move to the cities and the urban environments that a lot of this kind of thing was lost. We just had a family in our community lose their home in a tragic fire. And by golly, the folks rallied, and furniture and clothes and food and shelter and parsonages were donated. I mean, it was just, it's just what we, and that was what we would do normally. That's how we treat people. He wasn't speaking to me because I live like that, and the people, my neighbors, live like that. It's just there's a group in this country that got greedy and the Wall Street folks and all the rest of that stuff, that isn't what America's about. It's about us out here planting corn. I mean, and that's what Jefferson and all the early founders, with the exception of the Hamilton folks, were really talking about. And we need to go back to that, and I think it's a good thing.
Well, I think he agrees with you in terms of those values, that the kinds of things that many of us do at the local level in our families is the core of who we are. I mean, when he kept going over and over again, it's his old values. I'm not inventing new values here. It's old sense of responsibilities, his old share patterns of sharing and cooperating. I think the challenge always has been, and this is one of the things that frightened Jefferson, is one of the reasons he had great difficulty imagining an America that wasn't rural, that wasn't built around the kind of community you're talking about, was how much can those values, how much can that sense of shared of responsibility be extended? And all through our history, we've worried about how much in terms of space, how big a country could you do this in, how much in terms of difference, how many different kinds of people, different religions, different language groups can you have within a country? The whole challenge for us all along, and remember that Jefferson, Adams, Washington, all referred to us as an experiment. Mm. And democracy is an ongoing experiment.
We have about 5 seconds.
And the fundamental level is whether it's possible to be many in the sense that we are pursuing individual interests and different special interests. And
thanks very much for being with us. We're plumb out of time. Our guest is, I'm sorry we couldn't say an official goodbye, but we're out of time, Professor Wayne Fields, and we thank him. He's the chair of English Department at Washington University. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour and for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.